The World War II generation shares so many common values: duty, honor, country, personal responsibility, and the marriage vow, for better or for worse. It was the last generation in which, broadly speaking, marriage was a commitment and divorce was not an option. I can't remember one of my parents' friends who was divorced. In the communities where we lived, it was treated as a minor scandal. My crowd, which preceded the baby boomers, retained that attitude, but it did begin to unravel. At my 40th high school reunion, second marriages were not unusual, and there were a number of third marriages. There were divorces before and immediately after the war, of course, but the laws governing the dissolution of a marriage were much tougher, and society was not as tolerant as in later years. Of all the new marriages in 1940, one in six ended in divorce. By the late 1990s, that number was one in two. Although divorce has been a common fact of life in America since the 60s, World War II couples have not fully adjusted. They're still unsettled by its popularity, especially when it occurs in their own families. At reunions of various World War II outfits, almost all of the veterans show up with their first wives, or if they're with a new mate, it's only because the first one died. Those marriages, I believe, are more than a reflection of the expectations of society at the time the vows were exchanged. These relationships were forged when the world was a dangerous place and life was uncertain. Couples were forced to confront the profound emotions and passions that come with the reality of separation and the prospect of death. If their relationships could withstand the turmoil and strain of the war years, they should only get better after that. John and Peggy Asensio have been married since a month after Pearl Harbor. He was 23, she was 2 years younger. They've known each other even longer, since they were youngsters in Bensonhurst, New York. Peggy remembers, "When I was 11, I was on my porch reading. John threw a football to get my attention. I threw it back. That was it." Shortly after their marriage, John was heading for basic training at Camp Pickett, Virginia. He was trained as a medical technician and assigned to the 118th Combat Engineers, the men who went in with the first wave to clear the minefields, bust through any defensive barriers, start a network of roads and bridges for additional troops and supplies. It was vital and dangerous work. At home, Peggy was a teacher in the Brooklyn Roman Catholic Archdiocese Middle School system during the day and often volunteered at the Red Cross in the evening. She says, "I never went to sleep until I wrote John a letter. I wrote every single day. I wouldn't break the routine because I thought it would keep him safe. You bet I got to know the men in the post office." Peggy also followed the progress of John's outfit through the newspaper and kept an elaborate scrapbook of everything connected to his part in the war, including newspaper clippings and his draft notice. In the Pacific, John was on the move so much he didn't get his mail regularly. He saw action in five different campaigns over 23 months. His memories of Okinawa, one of the most ferocious battles of the Pacific War, still come to him in technicolor. "We were down on our bellies, and I saw one guy, his arm flying through the air. It had been blown off. I jumped up and put a tourniquet on the stump and got him evacuated. I don't know whether he survived." John still breaks down when he recalls one face-to-face encounter. "I was on a scouting mission, crawling, when I came face-to-face with a Japanese soldier. He looked at me, and I looked at him. I fired first. He went down. It was a horrible, horrible experience." It is all the more important to John that he won the Bronze Star for saving lives, not taking them. On November 12, 1944, at Dulog, Leyte, the Japanese sent a fleet of kamikaze planes to attack U.S. ships anchored in the bay. There were hundreds of casualties. John and another volunteer were on the beach, where they loaded a small boat with medical supplies and rushed out to help the stricken ships and wounded sailors for the next 7 hours. His breaks from combat were rare, so when he arrived in New Guinea, there were 58 letters waiting for him, most of them from Peggy. He read them in the order they'd been written, and he remembers to this day that in one of them, he learned that his grandfather had died. When he left for basic training, his grandfather had assured him, "You'll come back, but I won't be here." And then he had kissed John goodbye. What John experienced was characteristic of the personal turmoil in the lives of the young people at the time. While the men were in strange and hostile places thousands of miles from home, relatives died, wives and sweethearts were left to fend for themselves, children were born and Dear Johns were written. Sometimes it would be weeks or even months before the men would get the news, however disappointing, sad, or joyous. John's outfit was dispatched to Japan following the surrender. They were assigned to the port city of Kure, just southeast of Hiroshima. He was stunned by what he saw in the ruins of the first target of an atomic bomb. Hiroshima, he says, was the most horrible thing you ever saw. Just twisted steel, complete devastation. Asensio is firmly convinced the decision to drop the bomb was appropriate. Like most veterans of the Pacific, he believes the Japanese would not have given up, and there would have been an untold number of casualties during an invasion. One small moment during John's stay in Japan is a poignant reminder that wars are made from the top down and the people at the bottom, were it left to them, would likely find another way to settle whatever differences exist. John says he was under strict orders, no fraternization with the locals. But one day, he and a friend passed by the home of the postmaster of Kure. He invited them in for tea. The postmaster could speak English. You should have seen his garden. His little son took out a geography book and pointed to New York, because that's where we were from. We had the most delicious tea. Never had tea that delicious. We were going against fraternization orders. I still had my rifle, but they were so nice. Days before, the two nations represented by the four people at the party had been in a vicious war with each other. The Japanese family was living in the shadow of the wreckage of Hiroshima, the most destructive act of war ever. They were entertaining two young Americans, men who were lucky to have survived the deadly intentions of the Japanese as they fought their way across the Pacific. Now, they were enjoying each other's company and a pot of wonderful tea. I finally got back to New York on December 30th, John remembers. I missed Christmas, but I got a temporary discharge so I could spend New Year's at home. I rode the train into Brooklyn with a rifle over one shoulder and a souvenir samurai sword over the other. I looked so strange.